Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. I'm very, very happy, very pleased to be introducing our speaker tonight for the second annual Voltaire Foundation Digital Enlightenment Studies Lecture. This is something we started last year. I can't remember who the speaker was, but I think it went well. Yeah. And then we hope to keep going in years to come. And then we've coupled this with a workshop on digital enlightenment studies that's been really rewarding over the past few days. So it's really, there's some momentum going, and our tonight's speaker is a big reason for that. And so I'm happy and very pleased to announce Mikko Tolonen, professor of digital humanities at the University of Helsinki. Mikko is a trained intellectual historian, and I've always been very impressed by the way that he juggles the sort of academic rigor of what is in many fields and many places a very analog field, which is intellectual history, with very serious computational explorations. And so he runs the computational history group there in the University of Helsinki, who does amazing experiments, and I think he's going to talk about a few of them, if not more, tonight. So we're very pleased to have him. He's going to speak to us about books as objects, data, and meaning. Thank you, Mikko. Please give him a warm welcome.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn, and thank you, Nicholas, and everybody at the Voltaire Foundation. This is really a great honor for me to do this, and I really love to be part of what we kind of started, or you started, and we try to support that as best as we can. Let me say a few words about the title. So, books as objects, data and meaning. It aims to capture the kind of idea that when we think about books and in the digital realm, we want to see them to function on several different kinds of levels, which sometimes is forgotten. And first, for us, the way that we approach this is that they are physical objects, so the tangible artifacts that are shaped by production and circulation in many different ways. And at the same time, they are data, which is what the analog part wasn't always thinking. The carriers, or there's metadata that we can mold and modify, and there's textual information that can be analyzed computationally. And they are, of course, vehicles of meaning, which is the one that intellectual history always has been interested in, but the approach has been everything but computational. So cultural and intellectual expressions, readers interpret and then reinterpret across different contexts. That's what the thing that we are interested in is really about. And then let me emphasize this a computational approach. So we don't want to have, let's try everything. I'll be talking how we sort of have had a strategy and a vision for some time now, already before AI became a thing. But that's something, hopefully something that you get out of this talk. So what I want to do is to kind of present this holistic approach, that what we mean by studying books as physical objects, data, and vehicles of meaning. Then I try to offer some concrete data-driven insights into Enlightenment print culture. So for those who are maybe coming from the sort of traditional side, that's the most important part that we are talking. We are not trying to do something different. We are expanding the context maybe and the ways of interpretation, but the continuum needs to be in the tradition of Enlightenment studies and intellectual history. So all of that who are not doing computational are just as important as those who are experimenting with different kinds of ways. But the point is that the methods, they need to advance the scholarship also, so that we go in some ways beyond the traditional. Otherwise, there's no point for us to do anything in this realm. And then I'll try to sketch a little bit where computational history might be heading and how AI will shape what we call the digital enlightenment studies. So those are the three objectives. Now, in the idea of working and giving a talk, lecture in an intellectual history and Enlightenment studies, usually you would have a handout, right? Printed handout where you get a set of quotes, which kind of underlines that the work that we do in traditional way is somewhat anecdotal. So we are interpreting certain passages that are important. What I want to give now through this QR code, and this is now an experiment a little bit, so that if you go there, you will find a structure, you will find the articles that embed my talk. So there is this red number or a code, and you can look at which article I'm referring to every now and then. You don't have to follow this, but it gives you kind of like a sense of where we're going. So don't feel that you're missing out necessarily if you don't want to do that. This gives an opportunity for those who want to be multitasking, so that I don't get angry when if you're looking at your phone here. So you can do that. But then another one is that if you're interested in what we do, you can go back after this lecture, look at the structure, and then go through those articles. So most of them are available openly. So that's also the point. And you can you don't have to use the QR code. You can go to tinyurl.com, DES and hyphen Tolonen, and you can go there. So that's one of the points. Is there anything unclear about this? Because this is so if someone is still wondering that what's going on, but anyway, all right. Now, and this is the structure. This is how those articles are structured that I will follow today. So we will talk about what I call, or we call, bibliographic data science. Then we'll talk, I have two different kinds of examples. There will be more snapshots, because 1 hour is not enough for me to open up everything, and that's why you have the articles also. But I want to talk about canon formation in early modern Britain, a little bit about vernacularization and what we have called democratization of reading. And then I will talk about reception history in different kinds of ways for Enlightenment studies. And then I turn to this new type of place where we are now, AR for Enlightenment studies. A lot of the articles that we are working on that I'll be talking about through, for example, we do something called translation mining. That's something that hasn't yet been published, but it's so good that I dare speak about it. Well, let's go back. This is also a little bit of a personal journey and a journey about our research group. So let's go back to 2001. Here I am as a student of intellectual history, asking what is intellectual history. If you remember back in 2001, that was the golden age of this contextual reading. So Skinner is very, very, well, he's still big, but even bigger, in Helsinki especially. So a lot of the how to think about intellectual history is about context. And what I was started to think already then, this is me not being computational at all at these days. But what I was thinking is that, okay, if we really want to do this contextual, don't we want to then really expand the data, I mean, what we are working with? We had to come here to Oxford, Bodleian, or just to look at the books if we're working on 18th century. This is the back in the day, I mean, that's how it was. Another thing that was important for me, you see Mandeville and Hume there. So I'm a simple person coming from near Lapland, where the Enlightenment people thought that the not so bright people live. So I had a very when I was reading Mandeville and when I was reading Hume, I got a very, I mean, like that people at the time were reading Hume in a way that he's everything but Mandevillian or and so forth. For me, this kind of reception type of question that how is ideas changing, it really stuck with me for a long time. I haven't got rid of it anyway yet either. Another thing was that where do you get really the data in early 2000s? And this was the time we got ECHO-1 in a trial in Helsinki for 2 weeks. And I wasn't sure, is it going to go away? So for the 2 weeks, I sat in the library and I was able to get CD-ROMs and then download things. There was a limit, 50 pages at the time. So I sat through the whole opening time. I should have brought the CDs. I still have a big bunch of them. So I have this so I can be able to look at the PDFs. So that was the idea. The storage, I calculated, it would have taken about 25 years to download them at the time with that modem time, but didn't work. And of course, I mean, if we think about the interfaces, 18th century book, as we all know, survives. And if you have it in good conditions, the CD-ROMs, they break. And we don't know how the cloud computing and supercomputers and so forth will survive in the end, but that's where we are. So then my steps from being a traditional intellectual historian and then being involved with a great bunch of people from many different backgrounds, our computational history group. So I really, that when I was doing my PhD, I was getting these ideas that why don't we do this computationally and different kinds of ideas. Then when I finished my PhD, I started looking for twin collaboration. So I called one of my friends who was a professor in medicine, asked that, do you have anybody in your group who would like to work with me? I have these ideas. That's what we started doing. Then we got, it was two of us at the beginning. And then we had some funded projects. Some people came in. And then from 2014 onwards came this phase where intentionally took the agency to build a research group. Which in the humanity, it's not, there are people who do it, but it's still a little bit different kind of undertaking than working just in the funded projects that we were doing also. So that's kind of where how things were going. Now, for me, Voltaire Foundation, so my book on Mandeville and Hume, Anatomists of Civil Society, that was published in 2013. And that's the kind of, from there, 10 years to this point where digital enlightenment studies, and we had an article there also, so that this period of time here was very formidable in many ways, and I feel like that there's a little bit of a kind of overlap with how Voltaire Foundation is also transferring and so forth. This period when I had finished this book and was very serious, okay, now I'm going to start this computational seriously, people were advising me, my supervisors, that you have a decent career, don't do it, stop now. Then they said that, if you are successful, then that means that we also need to start doing this computational. We don't want to do it. Anyway, here we are. Helsinki, our group, so it's formed so that we have data scientists and linguists who look at the world and concepts in a different way than intellectual historians. And then we have a lot of elements of book history, people interested in semantic change, different kinds of historical processes and so forth. What is not always so easy is that to understand that, for example, if you have data scientists, these are not people who come to fix your computer. You know, they are serious scientists who need to be thought of in that way, so that we are doing work where the identity for everyone is so that you can retain it. And we're not like bioinformatics quite yet. So that to think about this and not kind of take advantage of anyone. That's the important part. But at the same time, we need to advance together and also think that where we're going to get our next funding and so forth and so forth. So there's a lot of different kinds of elements in this sort of collaboration that need to be taken really seriously. Now, our aims, this was done, this slide is from year 2017, so that what we are trying to do, and the reason why I want to show this is that we've had quite a consistent sort of strategy that we started already then. So understanding public communication and then also looking at the early modern Europe more broadly. Movement of ideas, so clearly saying that metadata work, looking at genres, looking at intellectual traditions, ancient texts, and how they are preserved, or how their reception and so forth goes in the early modern period, and then looking at also text reuse. And this coupled with conceptual change very much, so the intellectual history underpinnings there. We haven't done nearly as enough theoretical work in this line as we would like to, and it's something that also should be encouraged more and more in the Enlightenment studies in general. But then doing these data releases, doing tools, building tools for others, so all of this kind of going together was what we aimed at. All right, let me start now from this background, go to this conceptual and practical level of talking about bibliographic data science. And this is now the first part where you can look at some of the articles as well, if you like. So 2015, it was very clear to us, and we were very enthusiastic that we can map ideas in different kinds of ways, looking at coming up with this network that is great, and bibliographic data, when treated properly, is something that where we can take these steps and really look how, for example, natural law tradition in some sense is being published across Europe, and take that and combine with different elements and move forward, and also thinking about what is the reception of Mandeville or Hume and this type of elements, where it was really clear that this is a good way of thinking about it. And conceptually, I started reading quite a bit about what in bibliography and in book history people have been doing. And there is this debate about potential use of library catalogs and decades of debate about that. Of course, the debate about bibliography and science that Tansel and Mackenzie and others were engaging it with was a little bit different than what we are now thinking when we are talking about data science, and then the questions that in what way are we sure that you can actually use library catalogs to receive, I mean, to get decent interpretations of how ideas are formed and how they change, and what can you do also with respect to book history only relying on library catalogs. There's a lot of book historians who think that the archival evidence is the only way to actually move forward. We took the other way, and sort of you can still debate, and these haven't been resolved in any sense, and it's obvious that you need different kinds of approaches, of course. But our argument was that if we take this, what we call bibliographic data science approach, you can actually use in a scientific way these catalogs. So for us, the early on, Leo Lahti from University of Turku, it was him and me. I worked plenty with him early on. And this was kind of like a white paper for us, Bibliographic Data Science and the History of the Book, that was published eventually in 2018. So if you want to read that, what were the really the ideas that we had for this kind of approach, that is the article to look at. Much of it has to do with the aspects of harmonization. So if you just take any kind of metadata and think that now I'm going to get some results that are relevant, what happens often is that you end up playing with the data. So you are maybe just, explorations can be good. But our argument was, and still is, that you need to harmonize data. There are many different ways of doing that in order to get the kind of results that are robust and what sort of pleases also the analog traditional scholars. Mainly it's about the research questions, of course. So what you are asking is the relevant part, and then what data can you use in order to answer those. In 2018, it was a little bit of a shift. which was towards full data, meaning that we have images and we have the text. So the echo for us became here at the center. And the idea was very, very seriously that we are building this kind of knowledge infrastructure for Enlightenment studies. And this is also the reason we are able to do different kinds of things these days, because the combination of the ESTC metadata that includes, for example, having work level and edition level sorted, which when you want to do some kind of a text mining becomes a very, very crucial issue. So the combination between ESTC and ECHO, and then combined, of course, with other data sets like VIAF, if we want to look at the influence between French and English or British, we need BNF, we need Gallica, we need information about the printers and publishers, and also what we really want is also the newspapers. So the idea that if we want to study the public, we need to also, why would we only look at books? Why don't we also look at the overlap between newspapers when we are talking about public discourse in the 18th century? And this was something that not that many people are actually yet even doing, that cross-catalog thing. So for us to build from here onwards, that we started really seriously in 2018, moving from the library catalogs to this kind of a knowledge infrastructure, that's also something that has been very, very beneficial for us throughout and will continue to be so. Now, one thing that bibliographic data science combined to this type of work means is in this one article, A2, Anatomy of 18th Century Collections Online, where the idea was that we analyze what is in ECHO just based on the ESTC, which is the best. It's not, ESTC isn't perfect, but it's the best information that we have available. A lot of people want to use ECHO, but if you don't really know what is in there, might be a little bit difficult to justify your results. So just one example, if you want to study pamphlets in ECHO, and there is this kind of drop of coverage compared to ESTC, so going from 50, 60% to 30%, I would at least want to be aware of this before I start that kind of work. And this is what that combination enables. Also, there are like these big gaps. Some of them are known, so people know that there are gaps, but I wouldn't trust what for example, the GLS company, because they haven't done this, so they don't know. So, and I think that this kind of, it's a like preliminary work for any type of research you want to do using this kind of material. So for us, this is the bibliographic data science, what we want to mean before we start engaging with certain analysis that we are doing. Now, another part of the bibliographic data science is the relationship between unstructured and structured data. So the structured data, meaning, for example, metadata from the catalogs, this kind of classic bibliographic data approach, it's great because it's rather systematic. And then you have unstructured data, could be text, image, whatever, audio collections, anything that can also be analyzed in a systematic way. But it's not, I mean, and I don't understand why people don't think about it that, okay, it might be good to do some analysis, but why would you not think about it at the same time, creation of new structured data? So there's a lot of marked fields, for example, that are missing from the catalog information. But if we can use the unstructured data, for example, to create genre information or, you know, subject topics, whatever you want to call it, that kind of a way of working together in a shared infrastructure, if possible, this then will make us go much further. Now, example of this is that we've started working more and more with the physical aspects and images, for example, from the Echo. So already I was wondering one part that this comes, I was doing it by hand. So I was printing and cutting headpieces when I was doing my PhD, and then gluing them to the title. So the kind of looking at for variants of the different ornaments, and okay, why wouldn't you do this in an automated way? And well, because you didn't have the data, you couldn't. So that this is something. So for example, when I was looking for Mandeville, being obsessed as I always was, that how can people say that Thompson wouldn't be his publisher when all of the everything you look at in the book points exactly that direction? So to me, that the idea that what can we actually do with these is clear. There has, of course, been people who have been looking at printers' ornaments for a long time, usually doing it by hand. But there, the idea has been that the woodblock is owned by the printer, and there might be some lending going on. But the interest for collecting the information was always just to look for that one tied to Boyer or somebody famous printer, and not looking at the variants. So what we've done, there's also, of course, other people who work with ornaments. Not saying that, but there's been discussion whether the Echo quality, which is quite poor, is good enough for doing this. And well, we've been able to take the 700,000 headpieces from Echo and then cluster them in this kind of super and subclasses where we get these variants. And some of these are very interesting. So what is the intentionality of producing these where the eagle is looking inwards and some that are looking outward? And they are printed in Ireland, the other ones, and the other ones in London. And so there's all kinds of, it becomes like a big puzzle piece that we can then start mapping in different types of ways. And that combined to better printer metadata information, publisher information, there's also, of course, a lot that you can do looking at the type, looking at the fonts, and so forth. But a great way of going here, so that we are combining the unstructured and structured, so with the intention that we get better data sets, and that the project doesn't end here. Somebody will, when we are able to offer it to others, the work continues and we move forward. Also, so then you can really, I mean, that if you look at these two books here, one to be set to be published by Roberts and the other one by Thompson, and that's the Mandeville's later fable, and you look at the details, you may start thinking also about the author attribution in this kind of, the publisher attribution in this kind of cases. And so just an observation, so they are quite intriguing patterns. So some people say that, okay, Thompson was a publisher, the younger, so he didn't have in-house printing, and it was this Watts who did all the printing. But when he dies, some of the uses of the headpieces drops. They're not used anymore. So if they were Wattses, I don't know why that happened. And so there's a lot of this kind of quite an intriguing questions we are now working. There's no final thing that we have said about Thompson, but that's something that we are working towards with this headpiece information. So with bibliographic data science, what I want to say is that this virtuous cycle of better data, which is a never-ending process, we're talking about better data. So you combine the harmonized bibliographic data, text and image sources, and you come out with something that supplements and helps you. You use the images then to enrich the bibliographic data. There's a loop that moves forward, and then you can also use the text information in many, many different kinds of ways. And what is really important is that you develop this kind of with together with the use cases. So thinking about what kind of research question, in what sense is the data good enough? Because it will never be perfect, We would never be doing any intellectual history if we are just there to, let's get this data set to a perfect condition, and then you end up annotating everything by hand and so forth. So good enough and usable. But then you need to be also able to evaluate that what does that mean in different kinds of contexts. But this is very much the kind of core of why I want to talk about bibliographic data science. And, okay, I'll make this, so I'll publicly say this, that we are going to finish the cleaning of our version of the ESTC and make that available as open data. Ville, I corrected it from 25 to 26, so I give us a little break here. But anyway, so we think that this is a bit of a milestone, so then after that, anyone can work with it. It will include, for example, edition work relationship that will help you a lot if you're working, for example, with the echo data and so forth. So hopefully that will also help collaborative projects when people work with text mining and for example, LLMs and so forth. If we are not done by 26, it's Ville, your fault. Okay, then a couple of snapshots about what can you do when we are in a situation that this bibliodata is kind of in a sense good enough that we can start working with it. Canon formation is something that we've been very, very interested in many different sub-projects however you want to call them. This is one project that we worked with Mark Hill, who's here. He was our postdoc at the time. So we wanted to examine the early modern canon with the idea that what is a canon? Here we just took it so that what is published most often, most frequently, and for the longest period of time. So means that cookbooks and Shakespeare go on level as a starting point. And then we used the edition field information, the work edition, that was really crucial for this, and then publisher and printer information. And the main interest was really a kind of if we can see an epistemological shift in this kind of canon formation. There is an article before, so if you want to read it, I'm just going to show a couple very simple slides that what you can do when you are examining this kind of data. So here, okay, on the left, here's the full ESTC as published. Then if we look at the new first editions, it looks like this. And then our canon data is here. And it kind of breaks down quite nicely in the end when they are sorted by the first year of publication. This is the number of times they were published. There's a little bit of weighing going on so that later, there's no data ends at 1800, so that these works can be also included and it's not only earlier ones. Now, so then you can, of course, subset in different ways. You can start looking at most frequently printed, at least during one decade between 1500 and 1800. So if you look at what you find in this way, the works, there's a lot of things that you would expect to find, maybe some that wouldn't be so common, but that's not the point here. The point is that we can do this kind of examination and set it up when you have a certain interest. And ours was that if we are taking this type of a canon, which is justified also by the reason that the so-called London average of print runs works, and that's if you want to have more books printed, you will get out with the new edition. So that's also a reason why this is justified to be doing. Also, of course, authors publishing after death is important. Usually, the normal thing is for the non-canonical ones that once you die, they don't print you anymore for whatever reason. So here also you find very Voltaire is there, of course, and these are now remember the British ESTC data used here. So this was when 21 we were doing, but then our interest in Canon is constant. So there's many more articles. I just want to show one recent thing that we did. So we took the article's title tells you a lot. Quantifying the presence of ancient Greek and Latin classics in early modern Britain. And when we were exploring the data, there was a lot of work to get the canon, ancient canon right. So that was a lot of work. But what we noticed in a data-driven way, and what the article is very much about, is that one, while there was a, as a whole, there's a growing popularity of ancient printing, but what happens at the same time is the diversity diminishes. So the ones that there's many more authors that are printed in the 17th century, but in the 18th century it becomes very concentrated. So the so-called Matteus effect becomes very prominent. So the ones that are printed most are printed, and the other ones are kind of dropped. So we did a lot of different kinds of testing, whether statistical testing, whether that is right. If you're interested in that, please look at the article. It'd be good. So then vernacularization and what we call democratization of reading, these are also now just snapshots. So this work was done long ago, but I still find it quite interesting. So if we look at book printing in Latin vernacular, in Northern Europe, so there's now many more database for this than just the British case. What you notice quickly, for example, from this Heritage of the Printed Book database, is that the book sizes shift considerably. So we go towards much more mobile. So Octavo is the star of the Enlightenment, not Voltaire. So that it becomes quite clear. At the same time, the Latin share that is dropping. But it's so one thing to note about the Latin share is that it's not a synchronized move. Looking at the local. Differences, different cities have different profiles. So we can't say that there was a uniform move or something like that. Yet from here, you could start, the Latin part, we looked quite carefully, the different profiles. But from the document size, what do you want to make out of that? That's another question. And how red or thick you want to see the connection, that's another issue. But especially the drop of the Latin share might suggest that the reader community is at least getting wider. So also those who didn't go to college are starting to read, which is important part of this movement. And then combined to this is an article led by our doctoral researcher Iiro Tiihonen, was very interested about the kind of like looking at book history from the economic perspective as well. So probably everybody knows this idea that there was a monopoly in London and the book prices were kept artificially high. And then when a lot of people have been interested about this copyright ruling, that there is this public domain that comes, and then that the prices would have gone down considerably. When we looked at this from the perspective of price constraint, the obvious conclusion was that didn't have such an effect. So the reading still was mainly for book ownership was for the wealthy, and then more emphasis could and should be put on this kind of different kinds of circulation, resale or lending practices and so forth. But a good way, in my opinion, to show how this bibliographic data science perspective can bring a new aspect to something that has been debated over decades. The copyright question is a huge issue in book history, and this is about bringing a new perspective. We calculated a probability for the whole ESDC for the book prizes, and there was quite a lot of work gone into that. But if you're interested, please look at that too. Now, reception history, which is also something that in our workshop now over the day, 2 days, we've talked quite a bit about text reuse and such things. This is also something that we in Helsinki, we've been working quite a bit with. So we have run this BLAST bioinformatics software and all of the Ebo TCP 18th century collections online, and also then the British Library newspapers, Burney and Nichols collection. And we have about a half a billion text reuse pairs. And why that bibliographic data science for doing this is so important is that we also need to have the ESDC frame and the possibility of getting rid of multiple editions in certain cases if we want to really analyze that what is happening here. But so we're doing different kinds of reception studies, patterns of borrowing, impact in some sense, and also what we might call discourses through this kind of dissemination of texts. And what again, that knowledge graph that we want to see so that we go beyond one single digital archive. We have plenty of them. And then we are looking to step from some kind of simple textual overlaps to mapping ideas, so that we are able to classify and understand what the text reuses, for example, are, or what Glenn called today intellectually relevant text reuses that are more interesting than just mere Bible being quoted many times. So for us, I want to go back in time. 2018 was still relevant, the ideas that we had then. These were the basic questions that we came with when looking at the text reuse. So if we take Mandeville, what kind of patterns of borrowing did he have? Or what kind of habits of reusing his own works did Mandeville have? Often with text reuse, we tend to think that let's get rid of the author's own works because they are not interesting. In some cases, they are very interesting. And then, of course, who quoted Mandeville and why? So there's quite a lot of, if we are a little bit clever with like the simple data, we are able to do quite interesting things. And it's not always running for the next biggest model or something like that, but using what we have. And that's where humanities people could be much more effective and thoughtful in many sense. This is again the image from 2017, but I really like it because a lot of things came out because of this. So what we called Anatomy of the Impact, Mandeville's Fable of the Bees in 18th century. So what we have here is the beginning of the book, and here's the end of the book. These are count of how many times different chapters are reused, and then the color tells you when is the reuse happening. So what we notice here, that the beginning of the book, when there is Mandeville makes a lot of noise, so this part where private vices, public benefits is said, it's used in 20s and 30s, of course, people complaining quite a bit about it. But it's something that then vanishes a little bit after that. And then there's an interesting shift. So the chapter where he discusses luxury and pride, 1760s, there are many more times that this part is quoted. And then, of course, we can see what is not quoted at all. So Mandeville was a vegetarian. So he wrote a chapter called Why Man's Craving Flesh for Food is Unnatural, nobody's quoting it in the 18th century. So this kind of, I mean, like that, we can do this kind of anatomy of a book. I mean, of course, this is a like a visual way of looking at how different parts of a book are reused. But it's so useful, and especially when it's scalable. So you can do it for any 18th century books, because we have the Echo collection. And this kind of shift, especially to me, is extremely interesting. And also that the question that why quantity sometimes is matters, and we can see some kind of shift. Then, of course, I mean, if you want to go, we developed, based on mainly this idea here, we developed this reception reader. So if you go www.receptionreader.com, you can use this interface. We are very grateful to Gale that they let us publish this openly. So anybody can use it. You don't have to have a subscription. And it works so that, again, here is the beginning of the book. And here's the end of the book, and there's a timeline. All of these dots here are reused cases. So you hover over one. Here you see, when you're hovering over, it's interactive. You see which book are we talking about. And then you click on the dot, and it opens up the pages. So here on the left is the Mandeville's original, and here on the right is the Blewitt's book that is quoting this part of Mandeville, and it's highlighted here. Again, I mean, very easy, intuitive, and meant for intellectual historians who don't want to do necessarily anything statistical, but this is what people used to do. I mean, that you are looking, I mean, that do I find the same things? And here you can have an interface that does it very easily. So David Rosson from our group is the one the front end guy, so to say, who very quickly, when he came with us, we were able to put this together. Now, I want to show a couple things that you could do with text reuse that you maybe wouldn't think. Very ugly graph, but what you have in here in this matrix is Mandeville's, all of his own books and textual overlaps between them. And so one thing that Mandeville is very well known for is he recycles passages from his own works. And then he cannot be without quoting Bale or taking something from Bale, not quoting, but just taking material. This happens in almost all of the works, except one, which is Public Stews. If you look at the reason why Public Stews is attributed to Mandeville, it becomes quite questionable that is he actually the author? There's an article that's in the Digital Enlightenment Studies. We wrote about Mandeville where we talk about it. We are not saying that this is now concrete evidence that we have done everything to show, but this is evidence to at least think about it, that the way that people frequently quote, if people want to talk about prostitution and Mandeville, they quote, say that Public Stews is by Mandeville, but the reason why it is by Mandeville is that everybody thought that it is by Mandeville. So that the evidence is super slim. Also, if you look at the publisher information about it, there are reasons that you might want to doubt it. Also, one thing, so we've been, the way that we did this edition work and then collection level was based on titles from the ESTC first. But then when we have this text reuse information, what we did, we computed a coverage metric from ECHO and IBO TCP. And then it's a directed one. So which way is the, I mean, now we are talking about works of the same book, or might be a collection of something else. But the question that how much overlap there is between the same editions. We are involved in Hume's History of England for Clarendon edition. So we need this kind of a overlap question for many, many different reasons. But what you get here is a possibility based on the text reuse. So if we have a work and edition one and edition two have, there's 90% of material that is the same going this way and 75% going that way, okay, you can make different kinds of assumptions from there, but they are still probably the same addition. But when you have a situation where 90% of the text goes to this addition here, but only 30% is kind of covered like this, there's a good reason to start thinking that maybe we're talking about collection level instead of a work level. But for many, many different kinds of reasons, extremely important and one good way of thinking that how do we want to use this type of a text reuse material that might be seem trivial to someone, but it most definitely is not. So yeah, so just to the string matching the newspapers as an intellectual platform, that's something that I would really encourage people to think about, and also this kind of way of using this for critical editions. We are building a scholarly edition tool that we talked about that today, where this is coming to use, and also we want to make this available for others, so that making a kind of enlightenment studies move forward in this sense as well. Okay, AI for enlightenment studies. This is my last part. So this now for me is a quite a important slide. So we're trying to conceptualize between text reuse and something we call semantic similarity. And this has much to do with what we are able to do with embeddings. So also, if you want to say that, okay, what can we do with AI and large language models, this has much to do with it. So if we think about parallel texts and what is kind of overlapping or has to, what connects them in a way. So one way is to think about this kind of lexical text reuse, right? That includes artifacts. So there's a lot of, if you think about newspapers and books, the advertisements for books, so basically imprints are one of the most repeated elements. There's also OCR errors. You could study those if you'd like. Then the reprints, that's an interesting question for us at least. You have quotations near verbatim, and then you have also extensive reuses and secondary quotes and that kind of things. But then this continuum here, when you are thinking about semantic similarity, this is extremely important. Allusions, you can study them, but it's on red because we are not doing it at the moment. You can think about paraphrasing, and also what is really important for us is translations, full, partial, combined, and so forth. And then also something that we call meaning matching, and this is really, really interesting, but at the same time maybe difficult. So that when what is a meaning match, and when is there like an intentionality between someone commenting, and when are we just talking about topical similarity? But this is something that it's for us, the intellectual history and humanists to sort out. The methods are there, but we need to be able to define what we really want to do. So this is our sort of aim to make sense of what we are talking about when we are talking about text reuse and when we are talking about semantic similarity and meaning. So what we'd like to do, and there might be other ways also to think about it, so this kind of taxonomy of meaning or how do you want to do it. But the very important point is here, when we are thinking about the meaning matches, the multilingual language models are transformer models. They are able to do it across languages. So that language barrier is not a problem anymore. And this is what probably going to change quite a bit of research when we go towards the future. Here's an example of what is a lexical overlap. So a quote, there might be this kind of OCR noise, as you see here. And here is an example of a semantic similarity. So we have a small interface where you can type in about women's rights and equal to men. And then you get hits based on what it classifies as something that is closest to that. So that's an example of how that works. Now, maybe the most interesting thing about from this, where we are now, concerns this translation mining. So we created embeddings. So we turned the 200,000 books from Echo into these embeddings that are, so every single book is chunked so that they have their own vector, and then we turned the 300,000 books that we get from Gallica into similar ones, and then they are mapped, and there are different kinds of filtering steps. Maybe I don't talk about that now, but what we get is this type of as an output, where you have the English book here, the beginning and the end, and here's the French book, beginning and the end. Each single one book compared to each other, and then different kinds of filtering, what is relevant, what is not. And you can start, there are these diagonals that we are looking for then to recognize that what is a translation. Here's a very interesting case. You have a book that has a British introduction, no translation. Then you have a part that is translated, this here in red. Then you have some original text, the British have added here text. Then you have another translation part, and then you have another from a third another book. There's more translation here at the end. So you can do, I mean, or we have done this to every single one book that there are in these collections. And if you think about it, I mean, that cases that you could start developing from there, different kinds of intentionalities in translation. And also thinking about that, we are not interested only in the full translation, but different kinds of ways of doing the translation. That's quite interesting. And of course, I mean, like here, because there are these green that go to lower, our partner, Philip Ginter from Turku, he's very angry because he wanted all of the nicely on green here on the top, so that we could say that it works perfectly. But I mean, so that these different kinds of evaluation methods are just as important as doing the development of the methods that take us towards this direction. And then also, of course, there's a lot of manual annotations to check that what is actually a translation. So the commentary on Bible obviously isn't a translation most of the times, something on the same topic. So these kind of things you need to sort out. It's a probabilistic approach, so we're not claiming that it's 100%. But here, if you see a clear semantic and intellectual similarity, check it's a translation. And then for us, kind of what is important is also developing a kind of taxonomy of translations. So going a little bit towards the linear direction, that we're not saying that these are set in stone, but we want to kind of organize knowledge and think about the world in a way that we are doing different. And we are brave enough to say that there are some kind of taxonomies that organize the knowledge in this humanities world. And even when this class and that class are individual and they can be studied, you know, as objects of their own, but there's maybe some kind of similarity between objects. So that's also something that we've been developing. And then we get to the meaning of meaning. So Rousseau, man is born free and everywhere he is in chains, as it's translated into English. So what is interesting is the reinterpretation, use and misuse in different contexts. This is Anna Plassard. We did this together with Anna. So like really the interest in I don't want to say that everything is reuse or the meaning is reuse, but oftentimes the meaning comes from that. And so first it's taken as a Mandevillian criticism or criticism towards Mandeville. So there's vices, commercial society will lead us, French Revolution, suggestion to take arms against the monarchy. Then it's a claim against slavery. Some people said that, well, clearly it's a you can use it in the pro-slavery way as well. And then, of course, him being criticized that principle doesn't apply to women. But so what we can do algorithmically, so we start separating engagement. Now here the meaning comes through the engagement. So we see that okay, here is not it's not a text reuse, but a similar meaning, and there's an engagement to Rousseau. And there's then a context where it's understood, and those contexts are shifting. So a little bit about the question where we started, that what is intellectual history? But why aren't we in intellectual history interested in theory anymore? I mean, we really should be. And there's such good opportunities here to start thinking about this, also for the people who don't want to be computational. And that I mean, it's a silly thing that if we think that everybody needs to be computational, of course not. But I mean that these tools and opportunities need to be, you know, they need to embed what we are doing. Because otherwise we are just looking at Mandeville and Hume and you know, so that we can still do it, but let's move forward. Okay, I'll skip that. All right, so let me just say conclusions. So also with respect that if I'm thinking that use of computation in kind of historical humanities, it was for a long, long time, and still, I mean, summed up by it's mixed methods enterprise, right? So you use algorithms to spot patterns, and then you go to the classic close reading to make the interpretation. So that's quite often what people have been doing. But I don't think that the next step forward, it doesn't have to be another algorithmic novelty. I think with this kind of stuff, we have quite a bit already. So the tools are here, but then the theoretical growth inside, that will take us forward. So instead of kind of chasing for the next quick mix, genuinely scientific mindset that we are really blending the domain knowledge and rigorous data analysis and then this kind of large-scale infrastructure. Scale should be much higher than what we have here, for example. So then the ad hoc fixes, remember this kind of one-off topic models that people wanted to do, maybe still, but they postponed the kind of bigger ambition. So really sustained collaboration between historians and data science and so forth, that I think a lot of people are pushing towards that. So then the AI comes to serve us, and we are not just some kind of mascots in other people's projects. So also maybe this kind of computational hermeneutics, they should push the machine towards the, or beyond the preliminary pattern hunting. So maybe the modeling history, what does it mean and what do we want to do? So this should lead us to reshape also the interpretive act. So the interpretation is no longer something when the computer is completely put aside and then, okay, I'll think about it and make my own biased view of things. So iteratively and kind of in concert going forward. And I really don't think that this will eclipse, or the use of AI, that would eclipse anything from, take anything from away from us in a more substantial sense. And it will give us, sharpen the understanding of historical change and still rely on our interpretive judgment in a much bigger, grander scale as part of this kind of integrated interdisciplinarity. And of course, I mean, we will change as we move along, but that's how the world works. I think I'll stop here.